proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Linda Scott. May it please the court. This is an honor to be before the court. This is my first time in 23 years to have an appeal granted.
Well, we'll try to be gentle with you then.
Thank
you. That means you won't be gentle at all.
I understand that.
We're glad to have you before us.
Thank you. When I first noted this appeal, the statute for the human trafficking statute was a case of first impression. Since the appeal was noted, this court ruled on the Carr versus Commonwealth case, which I believe is distinguishable in that there were co-defendants, there was a conspiracy allegation as well. In that situation, the defendant or the co-defendants had shown the prostitute how to post ads. They had forced her into hotel rooms, which they paid for and they had the keys for. They, when she had left, they had brought her back, and specifically the defendant Carr had pistol whipped her in order to enforce their authority and to negate any of the will.
But force is not a requirement of this statute, is it? Because it's even a difference in the statute, isn't there, if force is, it's a higher class felony,
and
if
that
force is used.
That is correct, Judge. And in this case, what the court has focused on was the lower penalty statute, which is the intent to invite, recruit, encourage, or attempt to cause her to violate the standards of prostitution.
Well, let me ask you about that, because the trial court said, and I quote, this is a credibility issue. Either I believe Ms. Owsley, and if I do, the defendant is guilty. If I don't, he's not guilty. Why isn't that exactly correct? I mean, if she's believed, then all the elements are there, are they not?
Well, certainly this court gives deference to the trial court. However, I believe that there was enough inconsistencies in her statement to the police and her testimony and the cross-examination that I performed with her.
But we don't consider inconsistencies.
I think with the factual statements of it, it has risen to the level to negate her credibility, and that the court can see that the facts are plainly inconsistent with the trial court's finding. That's my argument to the court.
I get it. So you basically, it all relies on us concluding that the trial court erred as a matter of law in finding any credibility at all with the particular witness here?
That is certainly my primary argument for the receiving of the money. My argument there was that it was incredible with her testimony and her inconsistencies about $180 being in the Bible, and there's $120.
We have a lot of case law dealing with that, but what we don't have a lot of, and something that's occurred to me in the last year or so in a couple of these cases, is there's a statute that the General Assembly passed a couple of years ago that requires us, in essence, to consider all, in a sufficiency argument, which is what that particular assignment of error is, we're required to consider all evidence, whether properly admitted or not. Mm-hmm. So arguably, I mean, your assessment that the victim was so inherently incredible that she shouldn't be believed, it seems to me the statute might arguably override that, and maybe the argument should have been she should have been permitted to testify at all because she was inherently incredible. So, I mean, it's a nuanced thing, but that statute seems to me we've never, you know, interpreted in quite in this particular context before. But given that the General Assembly has mandated that we consider all evidence, whether properly admitted or not, here it was admitted. And I guess my question is whether, given the statutory language, we're required to accept it, and despite the fact that it might be considered incredible by some.
I would respond that that you are certainly, you have the authority to look at the inconsistencies and look at her to go behind. But I think also,
if we don't do credibility determinations, which we clearly don't under the law,
correct, sir.
Then where does that leave it? Because that's inherent. That's basically what you're asking us to do, isn't it?
I'm asking you to look at the inconsistencies and to find that it plainly contradicts the judge's determination in the fact that her response when I said
My experience as a trial lawyer, witnesses often are inconsistent in their statements.
And
whether they're materially inconsistent enough to, you know, that ultimately is resolved by the fact finders to how much weight they want to give a witness who has certain inconsistencies in their statement. And that's not an appellate court review issue. That's a fact finder, you know, chore that they have at the trial court level.
And I believe, Judge, that with her bias of her own charges that she had that ultimately were dismissed, and that was shown at the sentencing portion of that where I had asked her, do you expect to gain something from your testimony? And she replied, yes. And I said, your charges are going to be dropped. And she said, not yet. That goes to her inherent inconsistencies, I think. What it does is it emphasizes her inconsistencies.
Doesn't that essentially go to whether, in the case of a jury trial, for example, whether the jury should believe her, or in this case, the bench trial, where a judge should believe her?
I will agree with that, but I also think that her testimony has to go, in looking at the first argument, to the words of the statute. And so even in looking at the words of the statute, we don't have that Mr. Johnson invited her into prostitution, because while she was inconsistent, even the Commonwealth said she was brought into prostitution from someone else because she had testified against a previous pimp. She had...
She certainly conceded she was a prostitute before she even met him, and was after he was locked up.
Correct. And
can I ask you on that?
Yes, sir.
What, you know, even if he didn't bring her into prostitution, he brought her at least from Charlotte to Richmond. I think that's conceded, right? And so if he's going in and taking money and, according to her testimony, helped her post the ad on Backpage soliciting for customers, why wouldn't that be enough right there for the verbs solicits, encourages, or otherwise causes or attempts to cause a person to violate this section?
Judge, I believe that in parsing this out, we look at the laws that are in effect right now for misdemeanors and felonies. So just driving someone for them to go someplace to prostitute themselves is a misdemeanor. That's specifically stated in the statute. So in order for this to become a felony and a more serious crime, I do believe that there must be something else. And she testified that she wrote the ad, that he was next to her and helped her with some wording. She posted her own ad. She had done this before without his assistance. And she had... She bought her own supplies that were needed for her acts of prostitution. She had her own money. This was not a situation where her will was controlled in any way. And so I think there is a fundamental fairness argument with when she is in control, and unlike the Carr case where the woman had no volition and control and it was testified to wanted to leave. This woman testified she was already engaged in prostitution before she met my client. When my client was incarcerated, she found ways to prostitute herself. Even while we were waiting trial, she was released and was prostituting herself again without my client's
authority. But I guess my question is, we have to look at this first under the totality of the circumstances.
Yes, sir.
Sufficiency argument. So the fact that there's testimony that he had driven them a number of places besides from Charlotte to Richmond, but it seems like that's not in dispute, at least bringing her to Richmond. And so it's not just that he drove her here. I don't know what she's going to be up to once she gets to Richmond, because after that he engages with her. The evidence and we have to look at the evidence, I think you agree, in the light most favorable to the party that prevailed below. So if he helped her with the ad at all, if he is going in there and taking money out of the Bible, regardless of what the amount of the money is, after she puts it in the Bible, after the client gives it to her, and he comes and gets it, and according to her testimony, not just once, but over and over, why under the totality of the circumstances couldn't a rational fact finder conclude that he had solicited, recruited, encouraged, or otherwise caused her to violate the sex trafficking statute? statute?
Because, Your Honors, I do not believe that this code section has clearly defined so that a defendant is placed on notice what is the difference between helping someone and assisting them so that they are participating in a criminal enterprise. He was not charged with conspiracy to commit prostitution with her. She's charged with the misdemeanor that's ultimately dismissed. But because he's helping her with an ad and helping her with word choice, that she is in control of her phone, she is in control of her dates, she is in control of the information, all of a sudden he's charged with a felony. The mere driving of
Don't leave out the part about the money, though.
Yes,
that's significant.
So with the money, Judge, she has testified inconsistently that she didn't have control because he took the money, yet she's purchasing her own supplies. He did not pay for the room. It was her co-conspirator, Esther Evelyn, she had kind of different names. They also referred to her as Beauty, who this defendant refused to testify as to her role in it. And that was also part of the argument that she was using my client as a fall person because she wouldn't discuss Esther Evelyn's role. And it was our supposition that she, in fact, was the pimp of this girl. And I realize that the court is not looking at credibility, but I do think in looking at the totality of the circumstances, her will is not overborne, I understand that's the higher requirement, but I think we've still got to look at this because she's charged with a misdemeanor, and he's charged with a felony, and she's doing...
But that's the way the General Assembly set it up. In other words, historically, at common law, you can't be a principal in the second degree to a misdemeanor, only to a felony.
Right.
It seems to me what the statute, in essence, does is establish that if you act as a principal in the second degree to prostitution and add the additional element that you're profiting thereby by, you know, getting some money out of it, that criminalizes what would otherwise a common law not be a crime at all by making a felony out of what amounts to being a principal in the second degree to a misdemeanor. Which the General Assembly is perfectly free to do if they want to, as a matter of policy, which they obviously have done, as we said in Carr. What's wrong with that analysis?
And please answer his question. I just want to let you know you are going into your rebuttal time.
I'm sorry, sir?
I said please answer Judge Humphrey's question, but I want to just remind you you are going into your rebuttal time now.
Thank you, sir. I didn't realize that. Sir, I would think that in understanding that the General Assembly certainly can create a charge and decide the penalty for it, I do believe that where she is acting as her own professional protagonist and somebody is slightly assisting, I think that it does not put the defendant on notice as to what the assistance should be. And we begin to talk about, is mere presence enough? Is discussing the fact that she is prostituting herself enough for him to be found guilty of the felony? Judge Atlee rightfully directed me, I think, to the money issue of that. And I think that that would go to the second charge more related to the circumstances of the bellman where he directs clients to her. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions. I just wanted to have a minute for rebuttal. Thank you, sir.
You have your rebuttal time. Ms. Dunn-Parita, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Brittany Dunn-Parita for the Commonwealth. The evidence was sufficient to convict Johnson of both pandering and human trafficking. The trial court also did not abuse its discretion in sentencing. Johnson pandered. He knowingly received money from the earnings of prostitution. His victim, the prostitute Osley, testified that every time she would procure a client, she would then tell Johnson and inform him that she had received this client. When she met with one of her clients, she met with five in Henrico County, Virginia, she would receive cash money initially from them, then put that money in the Bible next to the bed. After having sexual intercourse with one of these five clients, Johnson would then come in and would retrieve the money from...
Mr. Imperio, we're familiar with the facts. I don't want to put words in your opponent's mouth, but it seems to me if you synthesize her argument, it essentially comes down to a situation where admitting that he received some money from the efforts of Ms. Owsley, that isn't enough under this particular statute to convict, given that she's, in effect, getting her own clients and so forth. He's simply experiencing what amounts to a windfall from her entrepreneurial efforts, I guess, as a sex worker. I'll put it that way. How do you respond to that?
Okay, well, so there's two convictions here. I think all of that is...
Well, I think we're really focusing on the trafficking conviction.
Yeah, all of that
here
is enough to constitute pandering. What the extra element in human trafficking is that the defendant must have intended to solicit, invite, recruit, encourage, or otherwise attempt to cause the person to engage in prostitution. And in this case, the defendant wasn't just a mere bystander. He was an active participant in it. So it wasn't just that he went in and retrieved the money. It's the fact that he also was with her when he was down in Charlotte and when she was prostituting. He took all of that money. He then knowingly drove her and facilitated her prostitution and encouraged her to prostitute by driving her from Charlotte, North Carolina to Richmond, Virginia. Then additionally...
If that occurred in North Carolina, what impact does that have on the crime in Virginia?
It can go to the knowledge, his knowledge that she was prostituting, and he wasn't just this mere bystander, just casually giving a ride to a friend.
Okay.
Additionally, he also helped craft her advertisement. She testified at some times that he would actually post the advertisements, and other times she would do it, and that on that particular day, he sat next to her while she posted it, and he helped her select the words to use. So that is more than just catching a windfall, to use your language. It's actually encouraging her to prostitute. Additionally, this defendant lied to the police when he was first interviewed, and he explained that the reason why he had all this cash on him was because he had been a tattoo artist in Richmond, performing tattoo artistry out of his other hotel room, and that was completely false. He had no explanation for how he received this $4,000, $2,000 of which were found in his hotel room, and $2,000 of which were found on his person. And the only explanation for how he was receiving all of that money is the victim's testimony that the defendant was taking the entirety of her earnings from prostitution. I think the fact that Owsley prostituted before is immaterial to whether Johnson encouraged her to prostitute in Henrico County. Because just because you're a prostitute doesn't mean someone can't continue to facilitate, encourage you, solicit, recruit you to do it in Virginia. And in this case, Owsley's will did not need to be overpowered. That is not a requirement under the statute. It merely requires that the person encourage, invite, recruit, or solicit the person to prostitute.
Can I ask you on the third assignment of error?
Yes.
I know you argued that it was not preserved because there was no objection or motion to reconsider or to set aside. If it were preserved, and of course it's within the statutory maximum, the two sentences of 10 years, right? But the fact that he departed significantly from the sentencing guidelines and based on a reason that appears to be clearly inaccurate, because she herself testified that she was a prostitute before, she was a prostitute afterwards, and the trial judge made some comment about the fact that the force that was used or something to that effect. How do we, if he has to give a reason for departing from the guidelines, how do we deal with that?
Well, Your Honor, he gave several reasons. He said first that this was a very serious crime. And then he did use language that the victim was dominated by Mr. Johnson, and I think that is actually true in this case because all of her earnings, she testified.
So it wasn't using force, it was more of dominating.
Yes. All of the earnings she had was taken by him, so she was left with no earnings, and we don't know how she actually received any money. So I think it's clear that Johnson was taking advantage of a person who was a drug addict, poor, uneducated, and was using her body to profit off of it.
Do I recall correctly that he had possession of some of their IDs? They were in his vehicle?
Yes, the ID of the other woman was found in his vehicle, along with a lot of her personal belongings.
But your argument is it wasn't preserved at all.
Yeah, my argument first is that it wasn't preserved. Second, there is no abuse of discretion, and that the nature of this crime meant that Johnson was dominating Owsley under the facts of this case.
Thank you.
All right, any further questions? All right, thank you.
I ask that you affirm.
All right, thank you, Ms. Dunn-Perio. Ms. Scott, you have your rebuttal time, and I'll give you an extra minute because we ask you a lot of questions and you ask for 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, sir. I would, in rebuttal, focus on the actions that happened in Henrico. There are misdemeanor crimes of driving a prostitute to a place so that she can prostitute herself. There's a misdemeanor crime of creating a body place. There's a misdemeanor crime of assisting a prostitute. So this new statute has upped the penalties, and it has made it a felony. And I think that it is unclear as to what the word assist is for purposes of the sexual intercourse. And the court right now has to take it on a case-by-case factual basis.
Why wouldn't we just use a commonly accepted definition of that word?
And so is it to assist her?
Or to encourage? I mean, they're all fairly common words that have a well-defined meaning that everyone understands.
Except that there are some misdemeanor code sections that would also
but
be
provided for. All that does is provide prosecutors with discretion. They can charge either a felony or a misdemeanor if they want to.
And if there's a specific statute on point, I believe that they should follow that statute with the law.
The General Assembly, in a lot of areas, General Assembly has given prosecutors a wide choice of charges to bring in. Sometimes they can bring a greater charge. Sometimes they can bring a lesser charge. Sometimes the elements are a little bit different. But, you know, that we essentially leave that decision up to the executive branch, not the judicial branch.
And I do understand that, but I do believe that the defendants need to be on notice as to what actions constitute what crime.
And well, that would be the indictment, wouldn't it?
And the code section, because in this case they amended the indictment, and we were prepared for it. I had noticed that there was a deficiency and talked to my client about it. So we didn't ask for a continuance to follow what the statute said. But in looking at what happened in Henrico is helping with words that she's created, that she stated she had created before with Evelyn, made the pictures with Evelyn. It's her enterprise. And so is just helping with the word choice enough of assistance that then this becomes a criminal statute. And there is a difference between the human trafficking statute and the pandering statute, which is the receiving of money. The third assignment of error, I would just argue that...
Well, hypothetically, if I were to help a friend word a note to be presented to a bank teller so I could rob the bank, is that enough to make me a principal in the second degree? I'm going to suggest to you the case law probably suggests the answer is yes. And if that's the case, where does that leave you?
I think in that situation, that is the specific, that's an element of threat, force, or intimidation. And in this situation, this is her advertising. And so it is only one method to the choice that she makes as to whether she makes a date or doesn't make a date.
Thank you so much. I gave you extra time on top of that just because we did ask so many questions.
But, thank you, sir.
We will greet counsel, and then the next case.